living through an incredible moment. And this week, as we continue to come to terms with the pandemic gripping our planet, another pressing crisis is once again dominating the news cycle. On the streets of cities across the United States and right around the world, an important reality check is taking place on the injustice and inequality in our societies. It's a time when many are rightly speaking up, and others are wondering how they can use their platform to lend support and to lead by example. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. In recent weeks, we've talked about messaging around brand and consumer engagement related to the coronavirus pandemic, and the need for strong yet reassuring messages from business leaders. We've discussed how to provide solutions for clients or customers and how to seek opportunity in a downturn. This is, of course, something very different. Nonetheless, in recent days, we've seen again that brands and companies are joining the conversation and are speaking out. But what is leadership at a time like this? For more, I reached out to Alain Sylvain, the founder and CEO of brand strategy and design consultancy Sylvain Labs. Here now is Alain with this week's op-ed on how personal experience informs leadership during moments of crisis.
The world of business has built up the idea of leadership like a godlike quality. There are books on leadership, schools of leadership, and self-proclaimed leaders of leadership. And while the idea is important to progress and community, many times leaders don't fully appreciate their responsibility at times of crisis. Health crises, economic crises, or social crises like what we're going through today. Constituents look to leaders to make sense of their context, to unite each other around a collective vision, and to inspire proactive action. Leadership is mostly easy until the stakes become high. It's mostly a privilege until it becomes a duty to symbolize a purpose greater than oneself. And in this moment, right now, leaders have a job to do. This is the life we've chosen. Business leaders find themselves negotiating a health crisis that has uprooted ways of working, slowed productivity, and threatened the health and livelihood of our teams, ultimately spawning an economic crisis, unlike anything we've ever seen, putting everything we took for granted, every asset, every contract, into jeopardy. Meanwhile, the U.S., yet again, is reckoning with a pandemic that precedes COVID-19, institutional, enduring, and overly excused racism. And unlike the coronavirus, that disease is in the bones of this country. It's in the undeniable history and present of this country. As I read this aloud right now in Brooklyn, New York, I can hear our collective exasperation and anger reaching a fever pitch and echoing through the streets. Again. And it's during this crisis that I've been reminded of my unique position as an African-American leader of a diverse team. I've realized that my personal experience has the power to color, so to speak, this moment for everyone. My clients, my teammates, whether or not they look like me or they share the same experience as me. It's through my personal experience that I can help the issue of police brutality and institutionalized racism feel more accessible, urgent, and visceral. My position and perspective on the crisis can't be divorced from my role as a leader. And instead, by leaning into my standing and point of view, perhaps uniting and inspiring those around me can be more effective. My personal unique experience, my life, has made my efforts towards leadership easier, dare I say, better. You can't learn about your individual experience in a school or a book. It's personal by its very definition. It's through our vulnerable embrace of what makes us distinct that we can lead better. Imagine what leadership can mean when we stop impersonating an ideal or objective archetype and acknowledge and put forward our unique selves. It's what made female leaders so powerful and necessary during the Me Too movement, for example. Or imagine leaders with military backgrounds during wartime, or leaders with backgrounds in science during this climate crisis. Our leadership is an extension or a vehicle for our uniqueness, our otherness. It's what makes leadership powerful. It's the life we've chosen.
Alain Sylvain, CEO and founder of strategy and design consultancy Sylvain Labs in New York City. My thanks to Alain. You can listen back to my conversation with him on episode 440, Surviving a Crisis, and our full conversation from 2018, one of my favorite shows to date, on episode 365. Throughout the pandemic, so many of us have come to realize how important the shops and businesses in the neighborhoods where we live and work are to our daily lives. Under lockdown, we've come to miss the small pleasures of life, like when we can pop into our favorite cafe for our morning coffee, or swing by the newsstand, stop off for a drink on the way home, or pick up our dry cleaning. Businesses help to make a community. This we know. But how often do we stop and think about what the greater impact of a thriving and successful local business is for the surrounding community? They can provide more than just provisions and services, of course, but also jobs and economic stimulus that can indeed boost the fortunes of many. And what about giving others the confidence to also set up shop? Today we'll focus on one small place, Islay. The island off the west coast of Scotland is, of course, famed for one thing, whiskey. But it's a place that has struggled in many senses. Not long ago, it was deemed a community on the edge, and not meaning on the edge of the world, but rather at risk of economic collapse. There are many factors, but in our globalized world with big box stores where much is imported, many small communities just like this have moved away from what they're great at, being self-sufficient and making and growing things right at home. Right now on the island, there is a shining star in the community of Port Charlotte. Mothballed a generation ago, but resurrected in 2001, the Brooklady Distillery has been on a mission ever since to boost the fortunes of its surrounding island community. Much of the focus has been on a very popular and important topic these days, sustainability. And to show their commitment and progress, last month Brooklady became the first gin and whiskey distilling company in Europe to achieve certified B status, a set of binding policies which verify social and environmental performance. Today we meet CEO Douglas Taylor, who says the company is inching ever closer to being an all-Islay operation, meaning everything from the water they source and the barley they grow to the distillation and bottling of the spirits happens at home. All that means local jobs. And as you'll hear, Taylor says he hopes Brooklady can help drive an entrepreneurial spirit on the Scottish island as well, to help the community's self-sufficiency.
So the distillery was closed in 1994, and it was resurrected in 2000 by a group of investors, private investors that were driven by or came from a wine background, and they had this understanding of terroir and they had this understanding of agriculture, and they wanted to bring that forward into the world of whiskey. And at that time it just didn't exist. It wasn't something that was considered relevant at all, and it was all about marketing. It was all about haggis and tartan and stag's heads and Monarch of the Glen and things. So what happened was a long journey of probably the first 10 years of trying to establish what that meant and what did it mean for ingredients and raw ingredients, how much did they matter, and the sourcing of them and who was growing them and the type of barley and the conditions that you would see in different areas of Scotland. They also were able to bring in their relationships with the winemakers from France, because they were specialists in Burgundy, so we had access to incredible casks as well. But it was interesting because the distillery had been closed for so long. In the beginning, the kind of fame of Brooklady was based around a vision, but not necessarily a liquid, because it was distilling something that wouldn't be released for the future, whilst selling for cash flow something that was distilled in the past by the forefathers of the distillery, if you like. And in that mix, all of the spirit that was there, that was inherited when the distillery was bought, was recast. So it had a new cask journey and a new adventure. And I think that's because historically Brooklady was an ingredient or a component that was going into blended whiskies rather than a single malt in its own right. So the casks were not necessarily full of life and giving life to the spirit and to the liquid. And there was a great recasking of probably somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 casks. And that's where you got the great stories about rum casks or Bordeaux casks or Burgundy casks, sweet wine casks, cognac casks and sherry casks from high provenance houses that we were working with or had relationships with. But the other thing was to try and establish relationships with farmers. So there was no history, official history or commercial history of barley being grown on the island. And again, this notion of Appellation Contrôlée, or this notion of a sense of place, or the idea that barley should come from the island, you know, didn't really exist. And of course the farmers there weren't growing crops. They were dealing with beasts, they were dealing with dairy. So slowly but surely we started with one farmer through to this year, so almost 20 years of relationship building. We've got 20 farmers growing for us on island. Actually, over 50% of our barley now comes from the island itself. So that gives you an idea about the high provenance nature of it. And there are nine big distilleries on Islay, but you know, we're the ones that are mainly focusing on trying to establish the notion of single farm, single field, single vintage, single estate. But it's bigger than that. I think the biggest point is about understanding agriculture, and we'll maybe come on to talk about it later, but the notion of sustainable agriculture and crop rotation and research and development, rather than just building a marketing story about, hey, our barley comes from Islay, there's a number of bigger questions there about how we farm, the impact on the environment, the impact on land health, the impact on ocean health, and what we should be doing as leaders in the industry to try and force a change of mindset from a producer's point of view and also from a consumer's point of view as well, or a client's point of view.
People will know Islay if they know a little bit about single malt whiskey. But, you know, the journey you're talking about, the story you're talking about is sort of reconnecting the whiskey to the land and the roots and the place. That's a fascinating one. And beyond marketing, as you say, how has that journey gone? You talked about some of the cask collaborations that you have done. But since you joined the company, what's that sort of been like in this direction you're heading?
I've been here sort of half of the journey. So if we think about the resurrection of Bruichladdich Distillery, and we often talk about it as this never-ending project. You know, it's unfinished and it's constantly striving to achieve and discover and to push for new boundaries. And that's a 20-year window, and I joined almost 10 years ago. And even 10 years ago, I think the idea about provenance, the idea about terroir, the idea about ingredients changing the flavour of the spirit, or the idea that it was important to run a whiskey company that had a consciousness about society and about the environment. 10 years ago, that was absolutely against the grain. Whereas now, I think there's a real rising tide of international spirits companies, high provenance spirits companies that are moving in that direction. It's much more widely understood now, and it's much more widely documented or more commonplace. And I think the one of the biggest parts of that journey is about opening the eyes of the consumers, or opening the eyes of the clients out there, because you don't know. I'm a big believer in you don't know what you don't know. So the message that's being peddled by the industry is only about age and only about cask, then by nature, received wisdom says, we think it's only about age and it's only about cask. So until you start to get first mover, or, you know, as we used to think ourselves as a bit of the lone nut, before you then get the first followers to come on board. And one of the most important things is that we've never had a vision to do this just for our own personal business gain. It's always been a mission to try and raise awareness, to drive change in the industry and drive change in the category. And what we see now are a number of different startups, and a number of those startups have come from those entrepreneurs' experience of companies like Bruichladdich, and actually people that have come and visited Bruichladdich and been inspired by what's happening here and going away and setting it up in, whether it's the West Coast of America or whether it's Sweden or whether it's Australia. So I think from that point of view, In the 10-year window that I've been there, I've seen a massive, massive shift in awareness and a massive, massive shift in expectation. And the whole point around transparency, I think, comes in the mix in there somehow, in terms of transparency about operations and transparency about ingredients and transparency about how your company runs or how you treat your people. And we now want more, or we expect more, if we're buying into high value. And I'm cautious about using the word luxury, but I think, you know, if you can buy a whiskey at $25 or £25 and you're suddenly thinking about buying an everyday dram that's twice that price, you know, that's £50, then there is a sense of it, of indulgence, or it's a sense of luxury attributed to that. And because of that, there is an expectation, you know, why should I buy this one? Why should I enter into your world? And one thing that we've been able to do, because it's been a long-term commitment, is we've been able to shape that Bruichladdich world. So when people come in and discover us, they maybe don't get the full picture immediately, but they can start to scratch under the surface, and you can have more than a superficial relationship with what we do, which is more rewarding for us and more rewarding for the fans of the brand.
That's quite interesting. And you talk about moving the industry forward. I imagine you don't look at other distillers that pop up in this sort of craft boom that we've seen in recent years as competition, but also as companies that can help sort of drive the industry forward and where it's going and being a little bit more sustainable and about where it's from. You know, we live in this interesting age where consumers really want to know about how things are made, where they're made. You talk about transparency there as well. I wonder if that sort of factors into the conversations you have had and how that drives the changes you are making. You know, people may be interested to hear about what Port Charlotte is like and what it's like to live there and work there, all those things. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it's nice if you can, you know, real place, real people, I think, is a big bit of the magic. That you mentioned something about the craft boom, and again, we're cautious around the association with craft, because I think craft was also one of these ideas that was jumped on by marketeers, and there was a lot of false crafthood portrayed and peddled across the different markets. And I read this great article that said there's such a boom in craft that even some of the craft brands out there are starting to distill their own spirit. And I thought, how can that commentary come after the boom? So it tells you about this separation, and I think craft is overused and craft is now also misused as well, and we've got to be careful about that. So I think the point you're making about Port Charlotte and the place and what it's like to live there is a really important piece about real place and real people. And I think that then feeds into who you are as a business, or who you are as a brand, and the way that you communicate. So depending on how you want to communicate, you can commission huge marketing agencies to create these wonderful big sexy brand campaigns that feature the product and feature a big shot of the landscape. Or you can be more like us, and you can be more organic and more natural, and you can set up global alliances and global partnerships, and you can portray daily life that's going on at the distillery, and you can also portray daily connections and partnerships that you've got across the world. And that again comes back to the discovery of the world of that company, or the world of that brand. So we do like to feature with Port Charlotte. You know, we talk about We Are Islay, and we feature most of the staff members in the campaigns, and we talk about who they are and what they do. And I think that's a technique that's been used now with other brands and things. But the way you do it, I think, has got to then fit into a bigger narrative and a bigger story and a bigger point of discovery about who you are, and a longer term mission. And you can form a much more solid appreciation for something when you feel how legitimate it is and how real it is. And it's not easy, because Islay, the island, it's a remote island off the west coast of Scotland, so it's difficult to get there. It was up until recently designated by the Scottish government as a community on the edge, and that didn't mean geographically, it meant economically. And I think to be able to do something for an island, which really is what's happened with the Bruichladdy story, is the resurrection of something that was shut down, but the decisions that were made could have been, we'll distill liquid, or distill spirit, sorry, and then ship it to the mainland, and everything else will happen on the mainland, or everything else will happen somewhere else, wouldn't have been to great benefit of the island. So during the time when Islay was in its, I would say, in its greatest need, so 20 years ago, decisions were made at Bruichladdy to say, well, what if we built an economy around farming and agriculture and barley, and what if we built an idea that we wouldn't offload our bulk spirit and mature it somewhere else, but we would mature it all here, and what if actually we would create a bottling facility so that we could create jobs for people, and that would then move into, we could create careers for people, because you then start to build different functions, and you then start to build teams, and the centre of gravity is absolutely on the island, and youngsters can come and join us and, you know, be successful through different areas of the business and end up working in countries like Singapore, or working in London, or working in New York, but they've come on that adventure. So for me, all of that hangs together as an incredible vision that's been very difficult to achieve, but through, I suppose, resilience, we've managed to get to where we are today.
Talk to me a little bit about where you are at. I know a bit of that vision is to be all Islay, to make sure that you're doing everything close to home and in part helping to rebuild the economy. So where actually are you at in doing that?
We're very close to having the dream all Islay operation. So we're growing there. We are distilling there, we're maturing there, we're bottling there, we're running our communications from there. We are 102 people or 101 people, and I would say 85% of that team is based on the island itself. The one piece that's missing for us is the missing piece of the jigsaw is the maltings. So at the moment we malt in the northeast of Scotland with our partner Baird's Maltings, so up near Inverness. So if you think about the geography there, you know, it's a fair distance to travel, and it's not necessarily the right thing to do for your barley that's grown on Islay to take it all the way up to the northeast of Scotland, malt it and bring it back. I think it makes sense when we're sourcing barley from the northeast. So some of our types of barley are some of the farming methodologies that we partner up with. So our organic barley comes from the northeast of Scotland, so malting it up there could make sense. The plan is for us to develop our own maltings on Islay at the distillery within the footprint. And again, that will sort of, in the sense, close the loop for us in the All Islay process or the All Islay project to that point.
Obviously, there must be some great pride in breathing new life into what is a heritage company from the 19th century. But I'm just curious about the impact on Islay. What's the actual impact been on other businesses and industries if we were to go there now?
So the island is brilliantly animated and an exciting modern island to visit. I mean, it's you go on a ferry, it takes just around 2 to 2.5 hours to get there. There are now 9, soon to be 11 distilleries there. There's a bubbling tourism industry. There's great hotels and things that are great visitor attractions in terms of museums and things that express the culture of the island from years gone by, or the history of the island and why it's got to where it is today. I think what it still lacks, and I'm a big believer in this, as are many of my friends and colleagues at Precladi, is I think it lacks that next degree of entrepreneurialism which used to exist. So the maltster or the baker or the dairy or the abattoir or the small brewing company getting stronger. I mean, some of these things are there. So there is an abattoir that's been sort of open and closed. There used to be many, many dairies that are not there anymore. We're importing a lot of, you know, lamb from New Zealand, and we're importing our vegetables, but we could be growing much more. So there could be a more burgeoning sort of farmer's market. There's a couple of great local business startups that are doing that already. But I think the next phase, and there's a great brewery startup that's been going for many years, but it's just been taken over by another group of young or not so young, some of them, startup guys. But I think that the next phase is about how does the island not become only reliable on or only famous because of distilling and the Scotch whisky industry? Because I think that's a mistake. And I think it could be much more dynamic, and it should be much more dynamic. And I think all of us, I'm not from Islay, but I am Scottish from the west coast of Scotland. So I've got, you know, there's a lot of parallels from these rural economies that I've grown up in and the island itself. But I think we need to try and promote and stimulate and be there to sustain the next wave of new business startups that will reduce our dependency on our reliability on importing everything from somewhere else. So how do we become more self-sufficient as rural economies, if Islay particularly, could benefit from that for the future?
Just to go back a little bit, we talked about, you know, living your philosophy and going beyond marketeering. You are announcing now that you're becoming a certified B Corporation. That is fantastic news. Talk to me a little bit about how important that is in helping the company sort of grow that vision.
I think it's really important to say that this is a huge moment for us to get that B Corp certification, to be the first gin and whiskey distilling company in Europe, to be the first single malt Scotch distillery, of course. The implication is that for the category. But also, and I think more importantly, it's a validation for us that the decisions that we've made or the projects that we've launched or the type of initiatives that we've been trying to build as a business have been the right things to do, because they've served a bigger purpose. And again, you know, we've been looking back at the timeline and the decisions that we made to build our own bottling hall and create jobs for the community. That goes back to 2002, or start organic barley in 2004, partnerships with the University of Highlands and Islands in 2005 to bring ancient land races to life. there have been, you know, the biodigester scheme that we tried in 2010, 2011, that we failed, you know, it didn't work. Our first green energy program was an absolute failure and it cost us a fortune. The fact that in the last few years we've changed things like improved pensions, improved holidays, the workforce is a management level is more than 50% female. All of these things together have been step by step, stage by stage, but to go through the process of B Corp certification as we have done, and it's taken a year and a half from discovering it, you know, a few years ago, to understanding the place that it has in the world, to understanding how that there was a real realization that, that the values we have as a business were completely aligned with the B Corp movement, so we could join up, and you know, that expression of be shoulder to shoulder with other leaders of business to use business as a force for good. And I know that's the kind of positioning line of B Corp, but to have a degree of environmental and social consciousness as well as just making decisions based on profit. So, I mean, that's been a big journey when you look at it all the way through. And what we've got now is this amazing culmination where we're open to creating that network and working with other business leaders to use the power of business as a force for good.
Douglas, this has been fascinating. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Daniel.
Now, before we go, it's time to answer one of our listener questions, which comes from Paulo Mendes in Portugal. Funny enough, it's a perfect one for Douglas to answer, but came in right after I spoke to him. So we called up Douglas again to ask for some advice. Here first is the question.
Hi, Daniel. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Paulo Mendes. My wife and I just launched VA Spirits, a craft distillery in Madeira Island, Portugal. We rely on tasting room sales and on food tourism as our major avenue. What can ventures like ours, small and family owned, do to overcome this tourism shortage we are facing?
A great question from Paulo Mendes. I think it's an important topic. The on-premise is going to struggle for a long time. It's going to bounce back at different rates in different countries. Some businesses may never bounce back at all. Other businesses may open up. I think consumer confidence is going to play a big part of it as well. How many or what the confidence level is for consumers to go back out into the on-trade, to the bars and to the restaurants. But I think the biggest pressure will come for these startup brewing companies and distilling companies will be around their tourism on site, so the visitors that come to the distilleries and the breweries, where a number of these smaller businesses rely heavily on the income that comes from that. And I wonder if that's where we're going to see the biggest pressure in the medium term, with visitor numbers dropping in tourism and affecting the revenue that startups and small craft beverage ventures are able to bring in. So I think we'll rely much more heavily on e-commerce. I think direct to consumer e-commerce and e-retail will be the thing that closes the gap. It won't close the gap completely. But within that, I'm sure we'll find innovative new ways of creating experiences, creating tastings, and finding a way to get our products through to consumers that weren't previously explored as thoroughly. And I think the experiences thing is a really interesting point as well, because we will be able to have direct to consumer engagement through their phones, through their devices, where they'll be able to have almost a virtual experience of visiting one of these distilleries or breweries. So I think that's where it'll move. It'll move digital, it'll move into e-commerce, e-retail in the short term, and then hopefully it bounces back to where it used to be in due course, but we'll also have these new innovative methods to hand to continue to build the businesses going forward.
Great advice there. My thanks to Douglas and to Paulo for his question. Don't forget to get your questions in for next week's expert guest, question@monocle.com. That's all for this week's show. My thanks to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.